I'd like to welcome you all to this session dealing with the writings of Orson Scott Card. It goes for about an hour. My name is Kenny Kemp. I'm an author. I live here in Salt Lake. I'd like to basically introduce our guests. Bill's going to speak first, and then later I'll introduce his nemesis, if that could be the case. I'll tell you a bit about Bill. Bill doesn't look like a Mormon, and that's true. He had a Mormon roommate in college a few years back that fascinated him with the ideas of community and the LDS ethic, and he became a great student of it. He got a PhD in 1991 from University of Kansas. He now teaches at DePaul, professor of philosophy there. He's written 7 books, and I'm not going to read the titles, but they range from books on social theory to avant rock, Bork and the Beatles. So when we talked on the phone, we had this great discussion about the Beatles. So I would have never guessed he'd look like this. Anyway, he lives in Salina, Kansas. Brings his wife out here. He's a musician and a bass player and an avid cyclist. I would encourage him to give a little story. I'm always interested in non-LDS people, what their first experience with Mormons are. And he told me a delightful story about a campground encounter with a huge Mormon clan in Salina, Utah, that I thought was quite interesting. So I'll turn the time over to Bill, and afterwards I'll get up and introduce Dan. Thank you.
Well, I think I look very Mormon. Have the same long hair that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had. I haven't been to Sunstone now for a few years, and it's nice to come back. I felt the need to reconnect, and it's very nice to see some folks out there whom I recognize, and look forward to visiting with you today and tomorrow. I love coming out here. As Ken was saying, I have become an avid bicyclist, and in fact, I think for somebody of my body shape and roundness, I'm a pretty good cyclist, actually. And I actually rode in a road race recently, and I thought that I should win a special award for being sort of the roundest person who could, in a field where many people are very, you know, Lance Armstrong, sort of very thin, I thought I should win a special award just for being in the race. But I actually brought a bicycle out with me, and I brought a bike I have that has lights on it. I went riding last night at about 10:30 around town a little bit. And, man, there are a lot of aggressive drivers in Salt Lake City. And I thought, you know, gee, I wish things were a little more Mormon out here in terms of a little bit more community spirit in terms of sharing the road a little bit. My paper... And later, maybe I'll share also my theory of the Bush-Cheney ticket, which I'm anxious to share with people, actually, because I think it's true, and I haven't heard anyone else saying it, but maybe that'll come later. I love talking about Card. I love reading Card. I've read all of his novels except for this very recent one that's a retelling of the Sleeping Beauty story, but I'm sure I'll read that before long. And I think if there's actually a specifically Mormon form of communitarianism, and I do think there is, I'd argue that Card is its most sophisticated interpreter and proponent, at least in his novels, if not always in his essays. Card develops an interweaving of basic Mormon themes, and he shows us their interrelation. I would also say that community is the central theme of his fiction. But flowing from this theme, Card also develops and deepens key insights from Joseph Smith and Brigham Young on the questions of redemption, memory, history, and materialism. The exploration of these themes in Card's larger-scale projects, especially the Alvin Maker, Ender, and Homecoming series, would require at least a book-length philosophical political treatise to set out in systematic terms. But I think this would be a very worthy project, and I would encourage anybody who's pursuing such a project. However, I think we can get a good sense of Card's philosophy, and that's what I want to call it here anyway, from a careful reading of one of his recent books, the 1996 novel Past Watch, The Redemption of Christopher Columbus. And I want to ask, just as kind of a preliminary, how many folks here have read that novel? Many? Okay, so a few, and I'll give a bit of a characterization of the novel, and I'm just going to take a very narrow slice of the novel that develops a philosophical, religious, political theme that I would like to get into it, and maybe I'll talk for about 20, 25 more minutes, and you'll let me know if because I also I'm very interested in hearing what Dan has to say and getting other folks' insight on cards thinking. So maybe we'll talk some about Past Watch and these themes, but maybe other things from CARD will come up and people can raise those. Certainly be very interested to hear insights from people. Past Watch is a good novel, though I don't know that you could call it one of CARD's best novels. And I have to qualify that by saying that to me CARD's best novels are really some of the excellent works of literature of our time. And I think this would be more universally recognized if there were not people, especially academics and intellectuals and critics, out there with some silly blind spots as regards genres of literatures. This is an old story by now, though no less irritating. And I'm glad there are at least some important literary intellectuals, such as Frederick Jameson, who championed science fiction and other genres that have been marginalized by critical establishments. If in terms of its purely literary merits, Past Watch is perhaps only a good book in the midst of a large number of great ones from CARD, which I think still means it's better than most science fiction novels, still in terms of its ideas, I think this novel is really profound. And my final comment actually on the literary merits question is that I actually thought Past Watch, and you know, this is a novel from it's 350 pages long. It's a novel from somebody who is used to thinking in very long waves. What the Homecoming series, what altogether is probably 2,000, 2,500 pages, five novels each, about 500 pages long. So this is someone used to thinking in terms of the very, very big picture, which is part of what I appreciate about CARD. I actually thought Past Watch could be 50 to 100 pages longer. I thought it could have, that many of the themes could have been developed at more length in the characters as well. But then, on the other hand, then I would recommend it for people who haven't read so much of CARD as a kind of economy of expression and in terms of the ideas that are in it. So what I want to offer now is a kind of one-sided reading of the novel in terms of its ideas and philosophy and what they say about the question of redemption. Past Watch is remarkable, I think, for what it says not only about the philosophy of redemption and certainly the theology of it, but also for what you might call its description of the physics of redemption. And in this, CARD develops the materialism of Mormon theology. And furthermore, I think the view of history at work in Past Watch is really somewhat akin to Marxism. And in fact, I think there's actually a lot of Marxism in the novel, or at least the perspective on history in the novel is not so different from Marx's perspective of history. And so I want to walk us through four passages from the book that illustrate these basic ideas that I think CARD is trying to get across. And the passages, unfortunately, that I was choosing are quite long, and so it's not really practical to read them. So instead, I think I'll just give a little bit of context and characterize them. And I'll give you the page numbers just in case you want to go back and look at this a little bit on your own. So I want to introduce these passages, say just a little bit about them, but then try to put them all together, keeping in mind the injunction of to Alvin Maker by the Shining Man to make all things whole. And I know I can't do full justice to the profundity of all of the ideas in this novel, but maybe we could work towards some sense of what redemption is all about in the novel. So there's four themes I want to talk about and pull them together around four different passages. And since most of you haven't read the novel, maybe I can just say a little bit about what it's about. The novel takes place in the future. We're not exactly how far in the future, maybe 100 years, somewhere in that range. So not the distant future, but not the immediate future either. It's a time when seemingly many of the large social problems of things like starvation and poverty and famine have seemingly been resolved for the time being, but not so far in the past of when the novel takes place. And it's also a time when there is a technological innovation that has opened up history to a new kind of examination, namely the creation of a machine that allows a new breed, so to speak, of historians to look into the past through a kind of view screen where they actually are literally looking at this or that scene from something that happened in the past. And they are part of an organization that's called the Past Watch Institute, and it's from that that the novel takes its name. And part of the story is about a young woman who takes it as her task, and by the way, this is actually another one of Card's strong female characters, I think, who around whom the novel is based, who takes it as her task to document the history of human slavery. And thereby, in her sense, in her view, in a certain sense, begins to, at least in some small measure, redeem this history in the sense that at least these folks who, for the greater part of human history, are unnamed and forgotten and obviously had their lives stolen from them, are at least now in some sense remembered. And so in that sense, at least some token of justice is done toward them. The first big moment in the novel, and I call this the call from the past, has to do with the fact that the historians are looking through it's called the true sight, this machine that they look through, at a scene in which some last few remaining free Native Americans are about to be enslaved by Spanish conquistadors and colonizers. And two things happen in this scene, and if you want to read it for yourself, it's from pages 37 to 47. And it's a long scene. Obviously, I can't read 10 pages. I wish I could because, of course, Card writes better than I do. But in this scene, there are sort of two main things that are very important. One is that the people who are looking at these Native Americans who are about to be enslaved suddenly realize that a woman who is a visionary among this tribe is having a dream in which she sees them looking at her. She can see them. She realizes that something up there is looking at her. And she has a conversation with this other person who has also drunk a kind of hallucinogenic, it's tobacco water, which sounds extraordinarily grotesque to me, being a militant anti-smoker type person, to actually drink that sounds horrible. But in any case, a hallucinogenic inducing substance, this other person who's taken it isn't having this vision, but they're talking about the vision, and they're saying, well, what are these, you see these people, what are they doing? Oh, they're just observing. They just seem interested. And to the historians at the other end, this causes some distress because it's clear that these Native Americans are viewing them as godlike or like angels of some sort and wondering why they're only observing us and seeing our plight. Why don't they do something about it? And at the other end, the historians are feeling great distress because they realize this is how they're being understood, as simply disinterested observers who just are looking on in a kind of, oh, well, isn't that interesting? These people are about to be enslaved. And the woman visionary, and this is one of the most, to me, poignant passages in the novel, calls out to these historians. She says, in her dream or in her vision, she sees that these people, or whatever they are 40 generations in the future. And this is, of course, why the historians start to think they're seeing us, because the timeline seems appropriate. And she says, oh, children of 40 generations who look at me from inside my dream, you see the suffering of us and all the other villages. You see the white monsters who make us slaves and murder us. You see how the gods send plagues to save the blessed ones and leave only the cursed ones to bear this terrible punishment. See, this is how horrible the situation is. The blessed ones are the ones who die from plagues and who are not brought into slavery. She says to them, speak to the gods, O children of 40 generations who look at me from inside my dream. Teach them mercy, And now here's what her version of mercy is. Let them send a plague to take us all and leave the land empty for the white monsters, so they will haunt, so they will hunt and hunt for us from shore to shore and find none of us, no people at all, not even the human-eating Caribs, who are another tribe who practice cannibalism. Let the land be empty except for our dead bodies, so that we will die in honor as free people. And as I said, the historians are very distressed because what can they do? It seems that they can only look on, and maybe they have the most benign view in the world, or at least they have this desire to remember the terrible things that have befallen those who've come before, but what can they do about it? Well, then the question arises, and this has to do with what I'm calling the physics of redemption. So first there's this call from the past. And it's, in a sense, a call for redemption. And interestingly, it's not a call that says, oh, you gods of the future, or oh, you looking at us from the future, save us. She doesn't say save us. She doesn't say resurrect our bodies someday. What she says seems like the most horrible thing. Send a plague to wipe us out, so at least we will not be forced into slavery. I mean, that's an extraordinary passage in and of itself. Then the question arises of, in a certain sense, connecting past to future, of some sort of intervention into the past. Because, of course, the historians, and in particular this one woman historian, is greatly troubled by this. And clearly, if they can see us, so to speak, she says, well, then maybe there is some way of having two-way communication with the past. It's not only us looking at them, but somehow they're seeing us. So maybe there's some way to send some message or something. And ultimately, it results in the question of even sending people back to the past to change things. And then there's this question of, if you could go back into the past, and this is not an unusual science fiction scenario, if you could go back into the past to fix things so that there would not be a history of horrendous suffering from some particular point forward, well, then why don't the same ethical obligations apply as in any situation where a person could act to alleviate the suffering of others? If somehow the technological capability comes about, then doesn't that place an ethical obligation to do something? As Kant said, ought implies can, but can also implies ought. If you can do something to help, then you have the ethical obligation to do that. And so then there's a whole discussion around that, because, of course, the physics of that, as probably many have seen in whatever, Star Trek or many other science fiction novels, if you go back into the past and change certain key things, you're going to change everything from that point forward. And at that point, the physicists get involved into this discussion. And what comes out of the discussion is the idea that if you change the past, if the future goes back into the past, so to speak, it will have never existed. And in fact, this is a very long passage. It's around about 190 to 200 is where this discussion occurs. It's a very powerful passage, because basically the physicists, in a certain sense, are laying out the stakes of what this redemption would be. That to go back into the past would be to completely empty out the future into the past. It would be the end of the future as it has been known, or the present as it is known to those who are proposing this. And what they say, to me, I found it very powerful. It's not as if the people in that present would have never existed. It's not as if. It's beyond the as if. They will never have existed, because the continuum, the time-space continuum in which they would have existed, would be eliminated. And so there's no sense anymore in which they would have existed. And so this places an even stronger and extraordinary historical burden, an ethical burden on this question, because in fact, there's a brilliant discussion in the novel about this idea that, well, in a certain sense, which would be worse, to have lived and had a life of suffering, or to have never lived at all, to have your life just canceled out altogether? Because in a certain sense, that's what they're proposing for every succeeding generation beyond the point in the past in which they're proposing to intervene. But it proposes, I think, an extraordinary conception of what redemption would mean, because it would mean the complete emptying out of the future into the past. And this goes way back. This discussion goes way back in Christian theology, back to the very first century of the Christian era. in the sense of the whole question of, well, when God became incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ, was this only a part of God, or was it the totality of God emptying himself out into mortality and into humanity? And I have this argument with fundamentalists all the time, because it seems to me if it was only part of God, then in some sense there's the infinite reserve that God is holding back, in which case what's the sense of redemption or sacrifice? If you sort of say, it would be like me saying, well, for the sake of humanity, I will sacrifice the fingernail on this finger. I mean, you know, but I'll keep everything else in reserve. Well, obviously that's not so magnanimous. So what does it really, what are the real stakes of redemption? I think the novel thematizes that very brilliantly. Third, there's this question, and here's where I think something like Marxism actually comes into it. It's determined and it's brought to these historians and physicists who are trying to develop a way in which they could intervene in the past, but they don't know whether they're going to do it or not. It's brought to them the what turns out to be the fact that the terrible things that had happened in the world in the recent past of the historians, the last 100 to 200 years, the things that we right now actually are doing to the Earth, basically have resulted in a situation where humanity is not going to last a whole lot longer anyway. And basically all that Card is doing is extrapolating certain things that are going on in the world right now and asking if we've actually already pushed things beyond the point of no return. Holes in the atmosphere, pollution in the oceans, toxins everywhere, etc. What if we found out that really, well, yeah, we think we're going to try to do some things to fix that, but it's too late. It's already a done deal that the world is gone. And so what you get then is very much like Marx's sense that the answers for historical, the questions, the historical questions and the possible answers to them somehow seem to come onto the historical stage at about the same time, that the resolution of the problem. And so what you get is a kind of material spur to carry out this experiment of intervention into the past. There's something that in some sense the gods, these people from the future who are looking at the past and then are looking at some way to intervene in it, there's some sense in which redemption is a real material reality for them just as much as it would be for those whom they were looking at intervening toward. And then the fourth theme that I would point to, and again, I'm just sort of setting out a kind of investigation that would be worth exploring at length, is really just the last couple of pages of the book, where there's this question of, well, this whole idea of that generation and every generation before that, but that generation that is alive at the time when they're having the discussion whether to carry out this historical intervention, that whole point about it's not even going to be just as if they didn't exist, they won't exist. But then there's the whole question of carrying those three people in the novel who go back into the past to intervene, carrying a kind of historical record of that other world that in fact does not exist, at least in the terms of the physicist, but which might continue to exist as a kind of narrative of the world that gave itself up so that these people could experience a better world. And of course, what Card is messing with, once again, in a just brilliant way, in my opinion, is the Book of Mormon. This record that is found, it is of another world. We don't quite know where it came from. Maybe there isn't really great archaeology to show what its provenance is and all of that. And yet there's something to it. There's something to it. There is some other world there that is speaking to us about our human possibilities. And how far have do I have maybe 3 or 4 minutes? Okay, well, So I want to just say something about some of the big ideas that I think are at work here. And sorry to sound like a school teacher, but you know, I encourage you to read the novel and hope some of this will ring true for you. One theme that's so typical in Card, and if you've read others of Card's novels, you'll see it right off, this call from the future, this voice from the future that may intervene. Well, in a certain sense, isn't that the materiality of God? I mean, isn't that the Mormon materiality of God? Because, of course, God is one who was just at one time like we are, but is now further down some road. and is calling back to us and is trying to tell us some things that might help us get our act together toward creating some sort of decent society and some sort of flourishing society here on our planet. The idea of God being emptied out in redemption, I think, again, just to restate it, he really has set the stakes for what redemption means. I think there's a comment here about works and grace, and I know this is a very common debate that Latter-day Saints get into with other Christians in terms of especially those parts of Christianity that want to claim that all salvation, all redemption is through grace alone, as though they actually know what they mean by that, which is always a question. Well, clearly here, there is a sense in which redemption, this coming back from the future to intervene into history and to sort something out and to open up another pathway, it is a gift. It is a bolt out of the blue. It is something that no one in that present could have done anything whatsoever to earn, even though it is also being called for. But is it, and I think this is where Card is so sophisticated, it is a gift, but is it the sort of gift that we hear of in more, I'll just call it mainstream Christianity, and certainly fundamentalist Christianity, that robs us fundamentally of our agency and responsibility? Because, of course, for Card, and I think from in a good LDS understanding, that's no gift at all. What kind of gift is it where you are redeemed at the expense of, in a certain sense, your life being sorted out such that you really, in no real sense, have a life because there's no agency on your part? You may as well just be some sort of automaton. I think he's dealing with that in a very sophisticated way, in a certain sense, developing what it means to be a responsible agent, the response that's the heart of that. And part of the response is the ability to accept the gift, but that's an active thing. I think in much of what calls itself Christianity, that's a very passive thing. You just, in a certain sense, lie back and let it waft over you. But there's no great activity, in a sense, that's, and you can run out all the possible metaphors and images that might go with that. There's no sense in which it's a real active sort of thing. Just a couple things to conclude very quickly. I think there's a very profound meditation here that people such as myself who are trying to do radical social theory, somewhat inspired by Marx and Marxism, I think there's a very profound meditation in this novel, in a certain sense, about justice and the resurrection of the body. And I've actually been thinking about this a lot in Chicago because in Chicago recently there was a discussion over, in a certain sense, reparations to African Americans and also this whole idea of the apology for things such as slavery and discrimination, etc. And I was thinking, well, in a certain sense, you could see those sorts of things, especially reparations, almost on a completely bourgeois model of just something like the class action lawsuit for harms done in the past, and now we want remuneration for this in the present. And maybe that ought to be done. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done or that people shouldn't pursue that sort of question. But in a certain sense, to equate that with justice is a whole other thing. And so then, well, if that's not justice, what is? What is justice, in other words, and redemption for those for whom they have never had a life? Their life has been stolen from them from the word go. And it seems to me that there has to be some very vital connection with this idea of the resurrection of the body. And what's paradoxical in the Card novel is that in order for this sort of redemption to take place, there also has to be this emptying out of the future, where those who would have their lives must also give them up. Secondly, this is just probably be very obscure to some people, but some may want to pursue it. There's a book by Jacques Derrida called Specters of Marx. Jacques Derrida is a contemporary, pretty well-known philosopher, was one of my teachers, actually, that meditates on these questions of redemption and justice. And I think there'd be a very interesting way of putting these things together. And lastly, I was thinking the second time I was reading this novel, that there's a kind of gift that we've received in our time. I came out of I went to graduate school after a period of being mainly a political activist. And in the 80s, especially around the whole issue of whether the United States and the Soviet Union were going to succeed in what seemed to be their aim, which was to blow the world to smithereens. And some days, certainly by the middle 90s, I think there were many days where I woke up and thought, this is really pretty wild that the world is still here, given the state of things 10 years before that. And I remember one year I was supposed to visit my parents during the summer, and I canceled that because Reagan had just come on TV and said that they had discovered Soviet MiGs on the deck of a ship in Managua or whatever. And I thought, you know, they're getting ready to drop an atom bomb on Managua. And thank heaven that didn't happen. But, I mean, if you can remember the climate of those times, the space shuttle blew up. I was just waiting for Reagan to come on and say the Soviets did it or whatnot. I mean, it was a very tense time. And from my perspective, what you had in that time were two regimes, two superpowers, that were both driven by logics of accumulation such that they had to come up against each other and that they couldn't back down. And yet somehow one side did back down. One side that was just as militarily prepared, I think, I mean, not in sheer numbers, but in terms of commitment, just as prepared as the United States to kind of go toe-to-toe around the world, proxy wars, the whole thing, did what seemed to me not to make sense in terms of the logic of that thing, which is that they had a stand down. They stood down. And it seems to me that, you know, I don't know what voices from the future were calling and intervening that allowed something like that to happen. And I don't know the physics of it. And obviously, who could say how it happened? But something happened that seemed like a kind of gift. That because that happened, we're still here today and we can have this conversation. And so it seems to me something like the logic that he's setting out in the novel is very pertinent to that. Okay, so maybe I'll tell you my Bush-Cheney theory during the discussion period, but thank you very much for listening.
You're going to make us wait. Okay.
Be all the more.
He's inspired me to read the book again as the depth of his perspective. Let me introduce Dan Witherspoon real quickly. He's going to respond. He's also a teacher of philosophy, teaches at UVSC, and his dissertation was Awakening Joseph Smith, Mormon Resources for a Postmodern Worldview. A lot of 50-cent words in that title. I'm sorry, he teaches at Salt Lake Community College. I apologize. He's been involved in Sunstone for quite a while. He lives in Tooele with his wife, Lori, and has two children. So, Dan, please, thank you.
I heard the paper for the first time just now with you, and in some ways, just guessing from the abstract, and I'm doing the same thing to my respondent tomorrow. I've been emailing him drafts as the paper finishes up all week. So I'm happy to allow the conversation to go right to Bill and his in-depth stuff after I just simply echo a couple of sentiments. I think just what I picked up on was an opportunity from this to explain how I sort of have also seen Orson Scott Card as a theologian of great power. So if anything, I'm echoing what Bill said right at the beginning. There seems to be a prejudice to say that, you know, the great novelists, the great storytellers can't teach us things, and I really think that that's absolutely something that has to be destroyed. So what I prepared here, and then just one, maybe before what I prepared, maybe just simply say that I really think, if anything else, from what I understood, and I'm hoping that we'll engage Bill a little bit longer here, this idea of the total commitment that we need to throw in if we're to redeem the world, that's a powerful image, and that is, what better theology is there than that? Something that will really get us off our rear ends. And and begin to think about how we dabble. Peter Appleby, who passed away, one of my favorite things about him was this ability to try to handle it deeply, you know, to take pluralism. And his favorite phrase was when people say, you know, I'm pluralist, you know, I love ethnic food. That was his feeling, sort of, that was the level at which we're often pluralistic. You know, that level, oh, I like other cultures, yeah, they're kind of cool, but instead you got to really take them into you and hold them and not crush them, and just that whole level of commitment is something that at least I got a little bit of an echo out of that you must be willing to really take it deep. This idea of Card as a theologian came to me as a graduate student at Claremont Graduate School, which has the Center for Process Theology, Process Studies. It's a very difficult philosophy to get into. It has its own language. Jim McLaughlin's here, who's one of the best expounders in Mormonism of it. He can attest that it's mind-bogglingly difficult because you have to learn another language. And yet, if you can catch on to what's going there, it is a beautiful and a powerful philosophy. And I went to Claremont to study it. And yet, you know, as I'm into it and I'm understanding it and, you know, really working hard through it, I'm heartbroken because they can't communicate it. You know, how do you get process theology or this great white Whiteheadian vision into the real world where you can actually do some work and make some changes and all that? And so process theology is kind of has this status of, you know, I'm a Christian who's influenced by it. I'm certainly a Mormon who's influenced by it and all this stuff. But, I ache for process theology to sort of be able to have a symbol system and to be able to have rituals and practices in order to really, you know, have an impact in the world. So as I just happened to be wrestling with that and aching for you know, these theologians who I'd come to admire and wishing that they could get things together, I came across some Orson Scott Card passages that sounded like the themes of process theology. And I said, you know, I need to give a paper at a Whitehead conference or something like that on process theology. And then certainly as a way of taking this vision and this beauty to a level where it could make a difference in the world. I didn't do that. But in my dissertation, I found Orson Scott Card quite helpful. So what I really had prepared today, because I didn't know what Bill's paper would be, is just to share with you one example of how I think Orson Scott Card's creative, narrative, storytelling, imagining an alternate universe is able to ethical Mormon concept. In my dissertation, I was trying to wrestle with you know, what resonances do we as Mormons have with this emerging vision of interconnectedness, and we want sustainable practices and all that stuff. And I felt like I needed to deal with our view of creation and our ontology that says you have a God who's an active, interested being. Yet, whenever God wants to work, God has to work through feeling, sentient, self-moving intelligences, you know, the basic stuff of the universe. So when God creates in the Abrahamic account, what does he need to do? He needs to wait and hopefully see the response of creation. And the gods watch these things to see if they were obeyed. Later, as the gods prepare the waters that they might bring forth great whales, the gods saw that they would be obeyed and that their plan was good. Joseph Smith wrote, "The organizing of the spiritual and the heavenly worlds and spiritual and heavenly beings was agreeable to the most perfect order and harmony. Their limits and bounds were fixed irrevocably and voluntarily subscribed to in their heavenly state by themselves." And so it's this concept, you know, if you want interconnectedness, if you want to be able to honor selfness at whatever level, very low levels for most things, higher levels when you get to us, you need to be able to articulate this resource we have and this two-way creation. How could creation work where you have God's going, this is what I want, and yet having to sort of at least honor the other stuff saying, I'll take that. I'll form and I'll go with your thing. So what I came up with is a passage from Xenocide. Has anybody read that one? It's number 3 in the Ender series. And it's a conversation between Ender Wiggin and the Hive Queen. And the Hive Queen is the matriarch of her insect-like species. That, you know, I won't give away the endings of volume. Anyway, he's having a conversation. And he's learning about her as a how she, you know, all the workers are really an extension of her. All of the other buggers, which is the term that the inhabitants had used for these, were actually part and parcel of her. And so here's what she says as she's saying how we create. And it just seemed like just a great analogy to this two-sided Abrahamic sort of creation. So I'm just going to read, hopefully, no more than 2-3 minutes and sit down. After explaining that the queen body is created first, the Hive Queen explains that she, in concert with the minds and intellects of past queens, never stop reaching or calling. Together they are searching for, quote, the us thing, the binder, the meaning maker. We call it to come and to take the queen body so she can be wise, our sister. Ender asks, you call it? Well, what is it? The thing we call. Yes, but what is it? What are you asking? It's the called thing. We call it. It hears us calling and comes. But how do you call? Well, we imagine the thing that it must become, the pattern of the hive, the queen and the workers and the binding together. Then one comes who understands the pattern and can hold it. We give the queen body to it. So you're calling some other creature to come and take possession of the queen? To become the queen and the hive and all. To hold the pattern that we imagined. An interesting dialogue then, you know, ensues. I'm skipping here, where she talks about how you have to have lower levels of pattern, bodies. If you think of any creation account, it always starts with earth and sky, lower things. So you have to have bodies that have already gone through this process. He says, this is incredible. You're calling for some being from another place. And no, the calling forth is nothing. All things do it. All new making. This thing. Grass and sunlight. All making calls them, and they come to the pattern. If there are already some who understand the pattern, then they come and possess it. Small patterns are very easy. Our pattern is very hard. Only a very wise one can possess it. And then here's where I may lose you a little bit. He says, Philotes, which is his name, I believe, for intelligences. This is card translated into this other thing. So he's going, the things out of which all other things are made. She goes, the words you say doesn't make meaning like we make it. Well, it's only because I'm just making the connection. So when you have a hive queen, you already have the biological body, and this new thing, this philote, this intelligence that you call out of the non-place where philotes are, it has to be the one that's able to comprehend the complex pattern you have in your minds of what a hive queen is. And when one comes that can do it, it takes on the identity and possesses the body and becomes the self of that body. And then finally they turn to the place of the non-place where the intelligences are called. And the queen explains the best that she can that this place or state is no placeness in that state. No where being. All hungry for awareness. All thirsty for pattern. All lonely for selfness. I don't know if that made any sense when you cut and you paste and you do things like that. But I guess what I'm just trying to say is a very difficult concept. Trying to put it out there. Orson Scott Card, obviously working through this, can come to the rescue. He can take a hive queen and make it an instinctual. You know, not making it humans where we think out of our heads, but just that's just the nature of the universe, to call and to want and to do these things. He's a powerful, powerful writer, and I took far longer than I thought I would. And thank you for at least letting me share that and encouraging us all, not only to read Card, but I just think... whenever we find something so difficult as I don't know, just the resources and literature for what we're trying to do. Thanks.
Sure, that would simplify.
Okay, let's see if I can express this appropriately. in your interpretation of Passwatch Redemption, which I have not read. I've read a lot of Card, but that's one of the ones that I haven't read. You have this discussion of the possibility of going back and in some way redeeming the past, and you empty the future as a result of doing that. Now, there's two sides to it. There's the more important side, which is kind of the soteriology of it. What are we doing to save mankind? But the soteriology of your interpretation is presupposing also a metaphysics of time travel, which is very similar, to a metaphysics of time travel that you normally get in science fiction, but which is and is entertained by physicists too, but is anathema among philosophers who talk about time travel when they talk about it. And let me see if I can just explain a couple of different views of time travel, and I just want to get your reaction to this. For example, one view of time travel would just be that it's impossible because of the grandfather paradox, which is obviously at the core of this whole. Yeah. Another view of time travel would be, no, it is possible, and this is David Lewis's view, it is possible, the grandfather paradox is not a problem. Every time you try to go, let me explain the grandfather paradox really quick, because some people might not know what I'm talking about. If time travel is possible, you might go back and kill your grandfather. Well, that would be a problem, because maybe you could do that before he even conceived your father or your mother, right? And so then you would have to cease to exist. And this is the very problem that's at the core of the reason why the future would then empty if you go back to the past and change it. And so the grandfather paradox has been a reason why philosophers have rejected time travel. David Lewis, on the other hand, argues, no, time travel's it's okay because whatever happened in the past is fixed. And so if you go back and try to kill your grandfather, just every single time, something happens that keeps you from doing it. And that happened all along. It happened so you can get this picture of you trying to go back and kill your grandfather, a very strange way of committing suicide. You try to go back and kill your grandfather hundreds of times. Every time you go back, you see some other person that looks a lot like you also failing in trying to kill your grandfather. So no matter how many times you try, you're going to fail, because that already happened in the past and you can't change the past. So that's Lewis's view. It's one that allows for time travel, but it doesn't allow for any changing of the past. Now, there's another view that some philosophers have accepted and a lot of physicists have accepted, and that's the idea that you've got parallel worlds, and when you go back into the past, you necessarily go back into a different world than the past in your world. Because as soon as you get back there, the past is different than the past was in your world, right? So, and so this is another way of reconciling it. But the kind of view that you get in Star Trek and Back to the Future, and apparently also in Card's novel, is one where you go back. You're not going back to a different world. You're going back to your own past, and you are significantly changing it. And you remember the image of Michael J. Fox looking at his picture while he's playing the guitar, you know, hoping that it looks like he's fading a little bit in the picture, because as the past changes, because he screwed up the relationship between his father and his mother, as the past changes, then he starts disappearing in the future. He's actually changing his own future, right? Now, as far as I know, not very many philosophers actually accept that kind of view. They seem to all be rejecting it. So here's my question after all that. What are the assumptions that they are making that you would say, obviously the soteriology, this redemption soteriology that you talked about, presupposes an understanding of time travel which all of these philosophers are going to reject. What are the assumptions that they're making that are wrong? Can you respond to them and sort of defend a view of time travel which maybe embraces the grandfather paradox instead of trying to solve it?
No. Did you ever hear this tape of Bertrand Russell once, where I think it was a Christian arguing with him once, who actually gave about a 20-minute long question and then said, "And how do you respond to that?" And Russell said, "It is false." I always found something appealing about that. You know, there is a kinder and gentler version of the grandfather paradox now, too, where you don't kill him, you just give him a condom. And that.
Oh,
so you don't have to kill him. I mean, come on, you know. Philosophers are always coming up with these really, you know, the most grisly version of the, you know, the example. Okay, but my real response is that I think in Card, as always, I mean, probably in this novel more than in any of the others, an attempt actually to come closer to what's called hard science fiction, where you research the science and try to put some good physics in there that is plausible as physics. I mean, not that his other novels are so soft, but I mean, I think he goes further in this novel than in many of the others. But, I mean, I still think his main point is something like that the question is, what can we do to make something of ourselves as a species? What can we do to make something of humanity so that one day we will have a society of mutual flourishing, a Zion society? And what is the connection between that and our history? And in a certain sense, and again, this is partly why I see it as engaging with issues that Marxists talk about. And you may know, I mean, there is this interesting subtext in a lot of Card's novels that is responding in some ways to Marxist understandings of changing the world and what the future might be. I mean, in the Ender series, you know, there's an important character, the mother of an important character in Xenocide is named Shang Xing, which was the wife of Mao Zedong. You know, I mean, in the Alvin series, there's, of course, the Shining Man who leads us on the Shining Path, which, yes, is a long part of Native American mythology and Quetzalcoatl and all that, but it's also part of the contemporary political scene as well. So I think he's, in a certain sense, resisting the idea that what the Zion society will be sometime in the future when people have a kind of shared abundance and say, and as for the long, sorry history of humanity before that, shut it out. The heck with it. We don't want to know about it anymore. Now we're in Zion. Let's sing the song of triumph. Because he's really working out this theme that, well, that will not be human flourishing if we build our great society, our good society, on, in a certain sense, the bodies and bones and blood, etc., of the many generations who have come before us. And, of course, that is a fundamentally Mormon theme of binding the generations, of going back and back and back and back and embracing all that has come, you know, that has come up to this point. And so I think it's, in a certain sense, that fundamentally ethical argument that he's wanting to bring the physics to bear on. But in a certain sense, I mean, just, I can't answer your question in terms of what philosophers have said about time travel, and I don't know that literature very well at all. But I think what he's really saying is that, well, what if something opened up in the technology, so to speak, that allowed us to do a certain thing that we would feel an ethical imperative to do, and that would bind this whole project into the common human project, not just of those in the present who have some irritation or suffering, not to demean the real sufferings people have to respond to, but that would respond to this whole history. And in a certain sense, that passage you were reading, Dan, I think also speaks to this quality and Card of the binding. It's, in a certain sense, a very existential quality. Where is the meaning going to come from? You know, here we're really kind of adrift in the cosmos. And where is the meaning of all of this going to come from? In that sense, I find myself in recent years actually sort of saluting Christianity as a whole for thematizing that question, even though I don't always think it gives very good answers to that question. But what is the meaning of our having even been here and the sufferings of humankind? I think that's what the physics is meant to serve. It could have been some other physics, or it could have been some other pathway into that. But I think that's the... I wanted to say, too, Dan, I'm sorry that I didn't get you my paper, but the organizer actually only told me you would be the commentator the night before we got in the car to drive 1,000 miles to come out here, and so that certainly I would have gotten... thank heaven I don't have a car phone, or I would have called you, but that's a price too great to bear, I'm afraid. Please.
Sure. I have a question for Dan about process theology. I just kind of started out in it. I had a course on God and the Western theistic tradition where we did, ironically enough, Whitehead's process of reality. Sorry, we did Whitehead's process of reality and Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption. A really strange couple of books to do in one class. But I know that process theology, and maybe it's not the right word to use, was kind of trendy with Mormon philosophers several decades ago. I mean, Truman Madsen's last series of tapes that were largely philosophical starts with a quote from Whitehead about process and reality and the possibilities that opened up metaphysically for articulating the nature of Mormon theology and what kind of view it gives of human possibilities. But when I read through process reality for the first time, I had misgivings. When you talk about this interrelatedness, I assumed you meant something like Whitehead's concrescence, but I'm not quite sure if that's what you meant. Now you're puzzled, so maybe that's not what you meant. And I didn't know exactly how it would best serve to articulate the kind of latent, unorganized metaphysics in Mormon revelation, because when you deal with like meta-principles of what Whitehead calls creativity as a principle of possibility of how reality is organized, and you deal with concressing towards eternal objects and all these things, it's really complicated. I can't explain off process theology. Maybe Dan can give you a primer on it, but I didn't know where you would really have the idea of a personal God still in the covenant relationships. It didn't seem like that possibly was included. That possibly seemed kind of precluded. And maybe I was misreading or not seeing how you could kind of alter Whitehead's vision in order to kind of appropriate it for the purpose of articulating Mormon metaphysics. But I'm interested in you responding to that, how you feel Whitehead could be appropriated and still retain what I think is really essential about Mormonism, and that's a personal relationship with God and man being of the race of gods.
I want to hear the Bush-Cheney, so I'm going to just simply say Whitehead has an ontological principle that says everything in the universe is just a difference in degree, not difference in kind. So we and God are on a continuum, just like Mormon theology has. When you say covenantal, I guess you're talking, it's a two-way thing. We certainly have that, and that was certainly part of this, that God lures, God imagines possibilities for us, presents them to us, and we, if you know you're a pretty low-level entity, like an electron or something like that, you probably just leap intuitively to it. If you're a more complex entity, you have the chance to reject it or not. And God is simply a lure that's always in your consciousness. So as far as the two-way promise goes, you've got me going here, but I don't know quite how, and still give Bill 1 minute to do Bush Cheney. Let's talk after it. But it is, again, I've chose Mormonism over process theology, and possibly those are among the reasons. So you took us away from Bill, and I wanted to get back to Bill for a second.
Well, I think in a certain sense what Card is saying is that if there's a sacrifice to be made for the sake of redemption, it in a certain sense has to go as far as it can go. And the way he sets that up, and including in the physics of it, is what you say. And so, yes, that's what I'm attributing to Card. And again, just to simplify, I think in a certain sense he sets the stakes for what we need to think about for what redemption would mean. My Bush-Cheney theory in one sentence is just that Bush's choice of Cheney as his running mate is a signal from the ruling class that they have chosen Gore to be the next president. Others have some insights on Card or some of this stuff. Please see me, give me the benefit of your ideas during the... I had 10 reasons for the Bush-Cheney thing. I really had 10 reasons, but we're out of time, so you can ask me later.
Thank you
Bill.
Very much. Thank you, Dan.